At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is, in my opinion, gaming's best journalist. He's just released his newest book, Play Nice, The Rise, Fall, and Future of Blizzard Entertainment. I highly recommend you read it. It is so, so awesome. He is the national treasure that is Jason Schreier. How you doing, man?
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's all right.
International treasure, really, since we're in different countries.
That is true. That is true. Well, you are known all over the globe pretty much now. But you'd probably be more appreciated where you are, I would think.
Sure. I'm the New York treasure. That's what they call me.
The New York treasure. Okay.
Yeah, that's my nickname.
There we go.
Up in here.
Jason New York treasure Schreier. There you go. We were talking a little bit off air about how you basically went about collating all this information together, right? From the interviews and then obviously all the research you do before the interviews and then trying to somehow put all that information into a book, what to leave in, what to take out. So do you want to go over a bit of that process?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. So Play Nice, The Rise, Fall, and Future of Entertainment, which comes out on October 8th in the States. I think it comes out a little bit later in Australia, sadly. December, I think, unfortunately. But you can get the ebook or the audiobook. Anyway, Play Nice. It took me about 3 years to report and write. And a large chunk of that was interviewing people, setting up interviews, taking notes on those interviews, recording those interviews, transcribing those interviews. And yeah, that's a whole big process. A lot of it is like, so as I'm talking to people, I will take notes and write down what they're saying and I'll kind of jot to myself down like, okay, this is an important thing. This is a useful detail, so on and so forth. And yeah, synthesizing that into a story is pretty difficult. What I did was for the most part, I broke up, I kind of organized my interviews based on where in the story they are chronologically. So like right. I was able to have one folder or one kind of, I didn't do it by folders, but I had like a master guide that I was using where I was like, okay, this part of the story, all these 50 people, they were here during the 90s at Blizzard. So I'm going to use those interviews for this chunk of the story. These people all worked on Hearthstone. So I'm going to use them for my chapter about the development of Hearthstone. And then I kind of organized it that way. And then just did the same thing that I would do writing an article where I just kind of outlined the story and figured out what it was going to look like, went through the interviews, figure out which quotes that I wanted to use, which anecdotes and information. And yeah, it was a very long process, but it was fun.
Sounds fun and
rewarding.
Were you working on it every day? Literally every day?
I mean, I was, if not actively working on it, I was certainly thinking about it every day for 3 years.
the reason why I ask is like, would you go away, come back and be like, wait, what was I working on? Which chapter was I doing? What part was I trying to write?
Well, so the writing itself, I didn't do the writing until most of the, I did a little bit of early writing, but most of the writing I didn't do until last year when I actually took book leave from Bloomberg. And so I took off for about 3 months, kind of split into two chunks. And the majority of the writing I did there, it was the reporting that took the 3 years. So like all throughout those 3 years, I might be sending emails, sending out messages, asking if people want to talk to me, reaching out to them, getting on the phone with people, doing interviews, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm going to call it right now. Someone's going to make a film adaptation of this book or a TV miniseries or something. I'm calling it because
I hope so.
Yeah, it'll happen.
I've had some adventures in Hollywood that have just led nowhere. So I've kind of given up on any sort of like opportunities like that. But I hope so. I would love to see it.
Yeah. Well, Hollywood's big on the video game adaptation thing at the moment. So
that's true. That is true.
So, you know, you call me when it happens.
Yeah, I mean, so you would watch that?
Yeah, for sure, man. Like it's got a good arc, I feel, and a lot of interesting things along the way. There was definitely some stuff that I was like, whoa, okay, that's me. I think one of the things that got me was like the sex parties stuff. That's crazy. That's like some P. Diddy. P. Diddy party.
Yeah,
thing.
Well, I mean, as far as I know, everything I heard about that part of the story was consensual. I haven't heard anything about that being, but yes, very strange. I mean, P. Diddy, he did a lot of horrible crimes. Let's not get that far. The people at least I spoke to who were involved in that kind of subculture at Blizzard, it was consensual on everybody's parts.
Was that like the...
But definitely strange. Definitely like not something you would expect to see at a professional office, that would be even like considered, like even something that is brought up or talked about. Like it's just very strange. And something that I think it speaks to is the lack of boundaries between personal and professional lives at Blizzard, which is, I think, one of the reasons that they had so many cultural problems, is that people's work lives and their social lives were just completely intertwined.
Yeah. Is that the only time you've heard of a studio doing that? Is that an anomaly? Like, well, having the whole sex parties thing. Is that an anomaly, do you think?
I mean, I don't know. I haven't spent as much time researching any other companies.
No. Well, but I'm just saying because you've spoken to a lot of devs over the years.
Yeah,
I've never heard of it.
No, I've never heard of anything like that. But it's like that sort of thing was just kind of like the way that I describe Blizzard. It felt in many, many ways to many, many people like a college campus. And it was like you're going in there, you're going on their campus. It's literally a campus with like basketball courts, and you're going on there. You're wearing your Blizzard hoodies the same way you might wear your kind of like Harvard sweatshirt. You're wearing that to your campus. You're hanging out with your friends. There are even literally there are like some apartment buildings that are very close to Blizzard's campus that a lot of people would rent out, a lot of like QA staff and stuff. And sometimes they were affectionately referred to as the Blizzard dorm. So for some people, it really was like being on a college campus. And so I think the personal and professional lives being blurred is like a big part of that.
Given the fact that you've spoken to so many people at Blizzard, do you think it's ever possible that they could be on the level that they once were? Or do you think that like Bobby Kotick has pretty much permanently stained it?
Bobby had an impact. I mean, I think I would argue in the book that a lot of Blizzard's problems were self-inflicted. I'll leave it to readers to decide which particular problems or how many problems or how much of the blame for Blizzard's downfall goes to whom. But I mean, they're certainly in a good place now. They just released The War Within, and that's been like their best received expansion for World of Warcraft in ages.
Diablo 4 is
doing well. Diablo 4 is about to get an expansion as well, which comes out hilariously on October 8th, the same day as my book. And so I don't think they're in a bad place necessarily right now. People are still digging Overwatch. Like, they have these franchises. It's just that they haven't really come out with anything new in a very long time. And I don't know if that's going to change anytime soon. But the games that they do have, people are still very into.
They're still very much into. But a lot of the old guard have left. And I mean, you still got Chris there, as far as I'm aware.
Chris Metzen is back. Yes, he has returned to work on World of Warcraft.
Yeah. Was there a particular reason why you wanted to focus on Blizzard? Why Blizzard? Why not Ubisoft?
Yeah, it's
why
a really...
not Naughty Dog, you know?
Well, Blizzard is a really good story. I mean, I think that Blizzard has 33 years of history. It's created more mega franchises, more billion-dollar franchises, more beloved franchises than any other company except for Nintendo. And it's kind of the equivalent. I've been calling it, when I talk to like mainstream reporters and folks like that, I've been calling it the Pixar of the video game industry, because that's what it feels like, right? And the fact that it had to deal with like this corporate takeover, and then of course the California lawsuit, although that hit a couple months after I decided to start working on this book, all of the kind of dramatic events that have happened there, it's just been such a saga. And that's really why I also, I mean, I happen to grow up playing Blizzard games and love a lot of them, but really it's the story. It's how good the story behind Blizzard is. Not just the recent drama, but also even, I mean, the first third of my book is all about the early days, and that is full of just incredible stories and wild anecdotes and all sorts of just really interesting tidbits that I think people are really going to enjoy reading about when they check out the book. It's just a hell of a story is the answer.
Yeah. Where did you decide where to finish the book? Because you, I think it, from what I understand is you picked, you started writing it around about the time that they were getting ready to sell, and then Microsoft purchased it afterwards or closely afterwards.
Yeah. So, I stopped writing the book in January of this year. Like I filed a first draft to my editor in January of this year. And, it initially had a very different ending, and then Microsoft, laid off 1900 people, including a bunch at Activision Blizzard. And that became my new ending. I sent a frantic email to my editor being like, "Hey, I have to write a new final chapter. Sorry." And to me, I mean, I won't spoil what happens, but like essentially that layoff was an opportunity to kind of end the story in a really satisfying way that kind of comes full circle from the beginning of the book. And so I really thought that was narratively fulfilling and satisfying. And so that to me was the perfect endpoint, actually. And I'm not that concerned with like things that have happened since then, or even just kind of capturing the future years of Blizzard that haven't happened yet, because the goal of the book isn't necessarily to be a chronicle of every single thing that happens at Blizzard. It's telling a very specific story, and it has a very satisfying, I think, endpoint to it.
Yeah. Were you, because I've found from speaking to a lot of game devs that I'm almost becoming a bit numb to crunch because I've heard so many stories about it, and it's just kind of like, oh yeah, another crunch story. But do you have that sort of same thinking now from hearing so much about crunch? And I obviously, you did a lot of interviews for this, and there are a lot of crunch stories, and like one in particular, like involving Breivik, because he did so much crunch on Diablo 2 that it ended his marriage, and he pretty much became estranged from his kids. And I've heard so many stories like that over the years, but I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
No, I don't think I've become numb to it. And hearing from people directly, it's hard not to kind of feel when you hear someone tell their story.
Well, what I mean, I suppose when I say numb, I mean more you're not shocked by it anymore. It's more like, okay, this is another one of those stories.
I'm really shocked by anything that I hear in the video game industry. There's so many like messed up things that happen in this world.
Oh, yeah, there are. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's been a while since I've truly been shocked.
It just feels like sometimes that like the industry is kind of just stuck in this place and it's unable to kind of move forward. And I think there's a difference between self-inflicting crunch and your manager sitting like you need to do 110 hours a week.
Sure. Although I think that when you have this conversation, I mean, the crunch I cover in my book that happened in the 90s is very different than the crunch that happens today. So kind of two different worlds. But even today, I think it's often a cultural thing more so than someone forcing you to do this thing. Like, sure, I mean, occasionally there'll be situations where a manager's like, "Hey, everybody has to work Wednesday, but Wednesday night." But usually it's more like, "Oh, everyone around me is staying here. Nobody is leaving at 6 p.m. Maybe I have to stay here too. Am I going to be the asshole who leaves when everybody else is still working?" That sort of stuff, like that kind of culture of like, "Oh, you're not here extra. You're not pulling your weight. Oh, I feel like I'm not going to get a promotion unless I put in the extra hours." That's the sort of thing that I think is more ubiquitous than like managers being like, "You must be here this weekend." And so that's kind of both self-imposed and culture imposed. It's kind of a weird thing. So I don't think they're kind of very clear lines differentiating the different types of crunch. And I think it's really important for managers to just kind of be aware of when that's happening and work really hard to push back against it or tell people to take care of themselves or whatever that looks like.
Is there one particular part or in the book that you think stands out as you're writing it, or one particular thing from an interview you did where you were just like flabbergasted?
About crunch?
No, in terms of the book, in terms of...
Oh, just in general, things that surprised me. I mean, there were a few. I mean, there are a lot of wild stories in this book that I just kind of... something that I hope people realize is how many stories here have never been reported and that this book is revealing to the world for the first time. Everything from, like, fist fights in the early days to the hotel band story, which is a pretty wild anecdote, to, I mean, certainly the sex party thing, as you mentioned earlier, that made me be like, wait, what? What is going on here? I'll tell you a fun anecdote. So this was in a footnote in the book where on three different occasions I would be interviewing someone on Zoom just like this, and then I'd see like their spouse walk by, or they would mention their spouse, and I would learn that I had separately already interviewed their spouse and not even known they were married. So that happened on three different occasions that I didn't realize that I was interviewing someone and I'd already talked to their spouse, which I think speaks to how incestuous the Blizzard culture was in terms of like romantic relationships on campus. How often this is happening, how many of Blizzard people like married other Blizzard people. It's really fascinating. And I don't know if you could like describe it as positive or negative. I think it's like a mix of everything. It's really just bonkers, I would say.
There's probably pros and cons to that. I don't know personally if I'd want to be around my wife that much, but you know,
people love it. I mean, working together with your spouse, that's another question. I mean, I think that in this case, so many of them met each other on campus, and that I think is kind of a different thing. Like, some companies discourage people from inter-office dating. Other companies, it's just kind of everywhere. And Blizzard was very much a company where it was everywhere to an extent I had never seen before or heard of before.
Yeah. One of the things that I was interested in was Blizzard and their like method to polish, because I've spoken to a number of Nintendo devs, and so I'm always interested in like the polishing aspect. And so there's a bit in the book how they talk about letting everything simmer, so they would iterate and polish ideas and discard others. And do you know if that was always a thing, or from the genesis of development, or did that come into the studio culture later, or is that it's just been a thing the entire time?
It was always a thing, but it evolved over time as the video game industry like learned what polish meant. And there's a great story the beginning of the book where they're working. They just created this game called The Lost Vikings, which was one of their first two kind of originally developed games, as opposed to games that ports they were working on way back in the day for like bringing some other person's game to another platform. With The Lost Vikings, there's a story where Alan Adham is at this game store near their office, and he's really stoked because they have a machine that is that you can play The Lost Vikings on. And he goes up and he sees this kid go up and like grab a controller and start playing Lost Vikings. And he's so excited. He's like, yeah, this kid is playing my game. And he watches him and the kid starts playing. And the first thing you do in the game is you have this character, and there's a lightning pit right on that screen, and it's supposed to teach you to jump over the lightning pit, but instead this kid walks to the right and his character jumps in the lightning pit and dies, and then the kid is like, oh, screw this, and he puts down the controller and walks away.
Alan Adham
is of course the co-founder of the company, president of the company at the time. He's like, oh, this is a problem, and he comes back to the office and is like, we need to make the beginning of a game way more approachable, way more accommodating, like we need to give players the space to fail right away, et cetera, et cetera. And that was kind of one of the learnings that they had from that. So I think even learning what polish is and what it means is something that you kind of, you get to, you know more about over time as you guys grow, as they grew as developers and as the video game industry kind of evolves. The other thing that I think was the biggest part of this is their playtesting. Like, they would have days all the time when every single person in the company would just drop everything and like playtest a game and play the hell out of it and just write down everything that didn't work. And that was so important to the company's culture and to the way that they made games, was just like that they all needed to really like it. It got to the point where, and this is, I think, still kind of true at Blizzard today, or certainly was as of a few years ago, they would know if a game was going to be a hit because they would look around like after work hours and other people at the office would still be playing it. And if people were still playing their game for fun, then they knew it was going to work out.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why there's a clashing between upper management or the execs at Activision and Blizzard's way of designing games, because they were all about profits, short-term profits. You got to make more money, more money, more money. And they're like, no, we need to sit here and iterate and polish and work out things. And
yeah, and you could argue that,
yeah, the back and forth.
You could argue that those are two extremes, right? And they're, I think that one of the problems is that the parties could not find a way to meet in the middle. And I think Blizzard tried to speed up timelines and it didn't work. And I don't think Activision ever tried to be more accommodating, but still, I mean, there was only so much they could do, because it's the same way. It's like, I don't know, if you're a parent, there's only so much you can do when it comes to getting your kid to do what you want them to do, right? Even though you're technically in control. So I think it was a back and forth that was just like terrible for both parties involved. But there is, I mean, I think that like, if you look at Blizzard, especially in the later days, that idea of iteration and simmering and like, quote unquote, when it's ready, looked a lot different than it did in the beginning days. In the beginning days, when it's ready meant like, oh, we're going to miss Christmas, we're going to come out in March instead. And that later would turn into, oh, it's been 7 years and this game still isn't out. So things kind of changed as the scale of the video game industry and the scale of Blizzard changed. And especially as World of Warcraft just became this constant revenue generator that could always be relied upon to make money for the company, even as other divisions were not hitting that same level.
Do you think there could ever be a point where the West, like, management would take a page out of Iwata's book in terms of a company or a game developer in this instance is struggling, so then the CEO and upper management take a pay cut?
I've seen it happen in indie game studios for sure. I think that I think a lot of CEO pay in America, while astronomical and kind of egregious, is mostly tied to stock. And so taking a pay cut would not actually give them more money to save jobs or like pay employees that money. Like, that's not how it works.
That is true, but it does create a bit of a morale booster. There was a couple instances with in the book where, you know, devs were struggling to make payments and stuff, and you know, a boss would rock up in a Ferrari or something, and I'm like, read the room, man.
Yeah. Well, that was the case. I mean, yes, that was certainly the case among some of the Blizzard executives, especially in the early days, who benefited from sales and other people didn't. And that was a story at Blizzard North for sure. But yeah, that was a different era than like the more modern era of people of CEOs like Bobby Kotick making tens of millions of dollars per year. Like, when you see that number assigned to a Bobby Kotick, that's almost entirely stock, which would then pay out when he sold the company to Microsoft and got a check for however much stock he had left. I think it was $400 million or something like that. That was all, I mean, essentially when he was paid the X million dollars a year, that was in stock that then cashed out at this point. So an obscene amount of money by any any measure. And there's certainly conversations that could be had about like, should anyone have $400 million? Like, what do you do with it? Do we live in?
Yeah.
What do you do with it? I mean, you buy a sports team, right? but it's not like, him taking a pay cut would free up cash that could then save layoffs. It's kind of a different sort of equation. I think that maybe you could say that equity could have been distributed to more people. That's another argument, but it's a little more complicated is what I'm getting at than just Oh, if he takes a pay cut, it'll save people's jobs.
I think it's more what it represents as well.
Sure. Yeah. And Bobby, actually, I think he did take a pay cut when the California lawsuit hit for that year. I think he did that as kind of a symbolic way of tearing his clothes or whatever, like showing remorse for what had happened.
Yeah, because there were times in the book, you know, and you've seen it in movies as well, where you've got one group of people, they come into the office and they get pulled into one room. And this is the room where everyone's getting laid off and pulled into another room and those people all staying. Mm-hmm. And
the good room and the bad room.
The good room and the bad room. Was that traumatic for a lot of the devs? Like, obviously, it's anxiety ridden at the time, but then even the trauma afterwards. Because I think one of the biggest problems is there's no safety net of any kind. And so I find it hard to understand how devs can focus on the task at hand when they have to worry at the back in the back of their head of a possible layoff.
Yeah, that scenario happened a lot more often in Press Reset in my last book. At Blizzard, it happened once by my recollection at Blizzard North when Blizzard North was imploding, and that was kind of its own unique saga and went through its own kind of struggles kind of as a result of, I mean, all sorts of things. It's gotta be miserable just knowing. I mean, I know people, I talked about this in Press Reset about how people I've talked to people who get anxiety when they hear the words company all hands meeting because they think it's going to mean they're losing their jobs, or like people who just keep their resumes up to date just in case. There's PTSD that I think comes with that sort of experience when you're just laid off, especially when it happens more than once, especially in a very short period of time. It really is traumatic. And I think that that's something that hangs over people and has driven a lot of people out of the games industry, as I document in that book. A lot of people are just like, oh, screw this. Like, I could go find better pay and more stability and better benefits somewhere else. Like, why am I doing this to myself?
Yeah. Makes sense. And also, like, the return to the office policy, right? Everyone has to be hands-on 5 days a week. Do you remember, did any of them speak to you about commute times into the office? I've spoken to devs, like, say, at Naughty Dog, and they were commuting 2.5 hours each way, some of them.
So with Blizzard, they didn't have to go back 5 days a week. They have to go back 3 days a week. And even to this day, it's a little soft. And I think there's some exceptions. There are a lot of exceptions. And then there are also kind of like soft mandates where like some people aren't actually tracking it. And it's a little bit fuzzier than just like a hard mandate. Commute wise, I mean, there's certainly people who live in Los Angeles and commute to Irvine, which is about 45 minutes without traffic on a traffic filled, like during rush hour. It's more like could be an hour and a half each way, which is pretty brutal. There's definitely people commuting to Blizzard.
But did they talk about at any point being fatigued by the time they got to the office? Because that's a long time. Like if they're commuting 1 hour and 45 each way, like by the time you get to the office.
Yeah, sure. It depends on the person and what they kind of how they schedule their lives. There's some people who everyone kind of has their own setup that works for them. Absolutely. Anyone who has to go through that kind of commute is going to be tired when they get to work or when they get back. I've heard stories over the years of people who just like didn't see daylight because they were coming in and at dusk and leaving at dawn. And yeah, it's brutal.
And there were people living at the office pretty much at Blizzard, right? When you're crunching, you're pretty much always there. You're ordering
in the
pizzas.
90s.
In the 90s, yes.
To be clear, like where that's, like I said before, there's kind of two different worlds of crunch, and the crunch of the early days of the video game industry and the crunch of today. That sort of thing, living in the office would not fly at the majority of video game companies today.
No. Well, thanks to your work, you've exposed a lot of it, eh? So.
Well, thanks to developers no longer putting up with it and speaking out and talking to press and talking on social media and stuff like that. I mean, I think we've gotten to a point in the culture where people are more willing to just be open about that sort of thing and work conditions in general. And I think that's helped a lot. There's been, I mean, some downsides to that too, in that, like, I think on social media, sometimes one person's story can be full of half-truths and, like, not quite capture accurately the, like, depict accurately the entirety of a company. So that can be a downside as well. But I think for the most part, this idea of more transparency among workers and people being more willing to speak out has really helped, helped with work conditions as a whole.
Yeah. And I think we need to be clear about this. Like, you don't actually leak information. Somebody leaks information to you, and then you're like a vessel for providing information. If somebody contacts you and then they tell you something, right, and then you're able to provide that information. Because, you know, a lot of people
in general,
I
mean, broadly, yes. I mean, if you're referring to, like, people describing me as a leaker or something like that, yeah, I mean, yes, it seems like a semantic difference, but it's important that a reporter is reporting on information, not leaking information. Sure, yes, that is true.
Are you still blacklisted from Bethesda, just out of interest?
As far as I know, yes. I guess I'll find out for sure when I ask them if I can do any interviews or get review code for Indiana Jones later this year. But didn't get anything for Starfield. So yes, I believe so.
Oh, I thought it might have changed with the Microsoft acquisition.
Yeah, I kind of. Well, the bigger difference is that Pete Hines is gone now, so that might change things. But I don't know. I haven't really reached out to them and asked if, like, I could, if we could repair that relationship. Maybe. I would like to. I certainly would like to talk to their developers. For me, being blacklisted, not getting review code doesn't matter to me quite as much as not being able to talk to the developers. Like, that's something I would love to do, is talk to some of their devs, talk to, like, the folks at Machine Games about their game. That'd be cool.
Yeah, because
good reminder. I got to reach out to them ahead of that game release. So thank you for the reminder.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. So where do you want to go from here? Like, you've talked about doing fiction, and I know in the past that you mentioned of wanting to be more involved in terms of, like, doing some sort of piece on the Japanese side of the industry, maybe like a Konami and Kojima thing.
Yes.
Have you had any headway on that? Or is that,
so,
like,
both of those things are true. I think there's a good chance, I would say, that my next book will be fictional. The Japanese thing, I mean, I don't think there's a good chance that I'll wind up writing anything like that. I mean, my dream book, the project that I would love to do, is, like, the entire sprawling saga of Final Fantasy from its early days to the modern era, talking to, like, developers, not just kind of the big names, but also, like, individual, like, engineers and artists and designers who worked on those games. But until I learn fluent Japanese and I'm able to, like, move to Japan for a year to, like, do all the interviews I would need to do, I don't see that happening, unfortunately. But that's my white whale. That's my dream project.
Have you learned any Japanese? Are you trying to learn Japanese?
Yeah, I've studied kind of on and off over the years.
The other idea would be to, like, hire a protege and kind of train them, you know, and
yeah,
they can
a Japanese person.
Yeah, and then get them to do the work for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cultural barrier is in place too, and that's a big one. I think that, like, Japanese developers in general, I think, are less inclined to want to just speak about their experiences. I think it's a little bit more of a kind of PR friendly, like, there aren't as many kind of independent reporters in Japan. It's more difficult to kind of get the real stories out from there.
Yeah. It does make sense, and they have a very different culture. I mean, looking at the industry as a whole, they just seem to be better positioned to navigate the difficult times ahead with AAA development increasing so much in size and scope.
I mean, it depends on the company. Square Enix is complaining all the time that it's missed expectations.
I think they are a bit of an anomaly, though. They seem to just always miss expectations, but then it's like their expectations are unrealistic.
Yeah, I mean, they might be an anomaly, but they're also one of the biggest Japanese game publishers. So if we're talking about the Japanese industry, I mean, it's like them and Nintendo and Sega and Capcom. And so they're like a quarter of the biggest, like four, at least from the top of my head. I'm sure there are others I'm not thinking of, but,
yeah.
So, I see what you're saying, and I do think a lot of those companies have been historically successful, especially in recent times, with Nintendo and Capcom both just really putting out hit after hit. But I think Square shows that it's not like there's something in the water over there that like is making everyone a success.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that with Capcom, they're in dire straits at one point, and they've had a renaissance, right, since Resident Evil 7. So it is possible.
As was Nintendo was in dire straits, too. I mean, wasn't that long ago that the Wii U era was upon them, and they were getting pressured all the time to make mobile games, to like do their own sorts of cuts and pivots. And now success is like seems inevitable for everything Nintendo does, but like it wasn't that long ago that they released the Wii U.
No, definitely. So do you have one story from the book that stands out to you, like when you're writing it, something that stands out to you specifically?
The problem with this book is no, because there's so many. I mean, I think every single page is just packed full of like either wild information or crazy stories about what it was like for them. And to me, it's there's a lot in there. So it's very dense. It's a very dense book. So nothing comes to mind. I think people really enjoy reading a lot of stuff about just kind of the development challenges and the struggles in the boardroom between Activision and Blizzard, and like the stories about the culture and how it changed. And there's a lot in there. I think anyone who has ever played a Blizzard game, or anyone who even like hasn't played a Blizzard game but like cares about business stories, I think will really enjoy this thing.
What was the dev's opinion of Zerza? You know, because he came from a consumer goods industry, and it seemed like in the book that everyone was, for the most part, frustrated with him because he just didn't understand how game development worked.
Yeah, Armin Zerza, the CFO of Blizzard for a while, was definitely kind of an outsized figure in Blizzard's history, that's for sure. The development teams, most people in development teams didn't have to deal with him at all, but some executives and leadership, and then also a lot of people in the non-development side of things did not have a lot of kind things to say about their CFO.
Yeah, well, it seemed like that was a common thread throughout the book, right? Because there's always that balance. I mean, what's your personal opinion on the devs in the suits? Do you think that a dev should be the one that's managing that stuff, or do you think it should be a dev that became a suit, or do you think it should be a combination of both?
So there's a part early in the book where this is kind of a conversation even in the early days of Blizzard, of like that the people at Blizzard South in Irvine, and also Blizzard North in the San Francisco Bay Area, all saying like, we want to run things, we're gamers, we know the games industry, we know this world better than suits do. And there's a part early in the book where David Brevik, who was the president of Blizzard North, the makers of Diablo, and Brevik was the director of Diablo 1 and 2, where he talks about how when they first signed a deal with Blizzard to make Diablo, they signed what he calls the worst deal in the history of deals, something like that. And I think that itself is evidence of what happens when you don't have a quote unquote suit. It's like sometimes the business people actually know what they're doing. And I hope that's a takeaway for people, or at least I hope the takeaway for people from this book is that there's nuance to everything and there's more than one side to every story, because I think seeing this as kind of reducing this to a narrative of like suits versus creatives, or like creatives good, suits bad, I think is kind of does a disservice to the story and to the history here and to the truth. I mean, I think that like for any company to be successful, you need people who know how to wrangle spreadsheets. I think one of the biggest issues for people at Blizzard was that was that someone like Armin Zerza came in and really put a priority on the finances in a way that Blizzard people were like, no, this isn't how we do things here. This isn't our culture. Our culture is like, you serve players first and then the money stuff will follow that, because if you make awesome games that players really love, you will make money out of it. But of course, that argument itself got more complicated when free to play came about, and it was like, oh, we suddenly have a brand new model on our hands. Like, this really changes things, because you can't just make a good game and sell it to people anymore. You have to like think about what the monetization is going to look like while you're designing the game. So
longevity. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, it just changes everything. I would say it changes the kind of, like, everything's very complicated, I would say.
All right. Well, your book is out on October 8th, and it's audiobook as well. It's audiobook.
Yes, you can, audiobook, yep. Read by Ray Chase. So digital, physical, and audiobook. No, I'm not doing the audiobook. Ray Chase, professional voice actor, is doing the audiobook.
Okay. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. Read Jason's book. And until next time, stay safe.